Yeah, interesting time that we are having this discussion, because more from your side, you've been through one hell of a journey or experience.
Talk about journeys.
Yeah, exactly. I'm assuming it has been. I guess we will definitely get into it, but I'm glad we didn't do it before, because now I get this whole other perspective. The challenge will be to fit it all within a suitable length of time for an episode, because there's a lot I want to explore with you, so time will tell.
Well, if we don't get through it in this hour that we have, or however long we have here, I'm actually made a podcast of the entire journey in the jungle, and so I'm working to start releasing those episodes soon, so you can catch everything, every like blow by blow, the details of my experience as I was going through. Yeah,
so at the end of this episode, give a few more details about that, but obviously I'll put it in the show notes as well. But that's a nice little teaser for listeners to stick around to the end. So let's try and start at the beginning and we'll work our way to it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Where do we start?
Well, firstly, thank you for joining me on the Journey Onwards podcast, Third Culture Conversations. Pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I'm so glad that we were able to do this from Peru, from Pisac, which is an incredibly special, sacred place in Sacred Valley. And just the energy here is just incredible. So I spent about a week here now, and you get drunk off just the energy in the air here. So I'm so glad that we were able to do it from here.
Yeah, I like that you said, let's try and do it while you're there, because you're right, it probably adds a different energy to the conversation. So I've been following a bit of your journey, and I've done parts of Central and South America, but I didn't make it to Peru. And Cusco is obviously, you know, very well spoken about. It's very traveler friendly. People love it. Or I've always been very, I don't say regretful, but it's a shame that I haven't managed to get there yet. But Pisac I'd actually not heard of, but just through your stories and what you've been saying about it, that most people end up changing their flight ticket, and even you change it a number of times. I love hearing that.
4 times. Yeah, the number of people that I've met here that said that they came here for a week, or came here for a month, or 3 months, and are still here 3, 5, 12 years later, that story has become like completely old now, because it's like everyone that I meet that lives here, that is not, a local, has a story like that. And I've changed my flight 4 times since I got to Cusco, because there's just so much that I want to experience. And also, I think another part of it is me integrating my very powerful 30-day plant medicine dieta that I just completed in the jungle of Peru near Iquitos. So just integrating that really powerful, difficult, but profound experience has been like another important, thing. So I think Pisac, just being such a hub of spirituality and sort of alternative lifestyles in general, it's just such an amazing environment to do that integration work that I think I really needed to do. If I just hopped on a plane and went straight back to the States, I think it would have been a very different experience. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how I would be able to really process and sustain the lessons that I learned in the jungle. Yeah.
No, that makes sense. I cannot wait to get into that. But, tell me a bit about your background, whether you start with, your grandparents' journey, your parents' journey, or even your journey. You know, where did it all begin for you?
Yeah, so, I look very Indian, people would say, but I'm actually South African. And I know you've had a number of South Africans of Indian descent on your podcast already. So I won't go deep into the history, because I know that's been covered quite extensively. But on my mother's side, they're actually Muslim. And I think they originated from parts of India that would now be called Pakistan, but before Pakistan existed, so they're Urdu speaking. But my grandmother also has Arab lineage. And then on my father's side, it is South Indian Tamil, Tamil Nadu area of South India. But, we really don't have a connection with India. We don't have family in India. We don't know which villages we originated from or anything like that, because we've been in South Africa so long. Just to put it in perspective, my great grandmother was born in South Africa.
Hmm. Okay.
So she spoke only Tamil and Zulu, and she was one of the indentured laborers that came to South Africa with the British, or at least her parents were, her lineage was. They came to South Africa with the British, in seeking a better life, and then ended up kind of being enslaved essentially for a number of years, working off their passage and their other expenses that continued to rack up. It was just a really sour deal at the end of the day. But that's the lineage that I come from, especially on my father's side. My mother's side, it's a little bit vague, but I think they came later. The Muslims came later as traders.
So, if people don't know it, the history of especially slavery and slave trade in South Africa is so deep, and it's, I say was, some of it sort of the trickle on effects very much still exist today. The Dutch came, and then the Brits came and kind of carried on where the Dutch left off, and the Dutch moved a bit north. But in terms of, I guess, from your perspective of what you know about your family, is there, does this leave a bit of a bitter perspective or opinion on the Brits for what they did and the way they were?
It is a really something I've been contemplating deeply recently, because just so firstly, this is a small correction. So the Dutch came and they just had a they weren't colonizing the country. They just had a small port at the Cape, in the Cape, for the Dutch East India Company as a refueling station. So they really didn't colonize, and they had a small colony of Dutch people working the land. And then the British came and colonized the country, and they were the first Europeans to colonize the country. And I say Europeans because the Zulus had colonized the country before that. They came south from, the northern on the east coast, and they traveled south, colonizing the country, and waging war against local tribes. And, so there's the country has a long history of colonization even before the Europeans came. So then the British came, and they tried to enslave the Dutch, who then decided to leave the British rule, and then there were a couple of wars, the Anglo-Boer wars and everything else. The British tried very hard to enslave, or at least get the local African people to work for them on their farms, especially on the East Coast. But this was really difficult given the sort of the very independent nature of African people and the culture back then. Very different to what you'd say about local black people after, 250 years of systematic oppression and apartheid. But at that stage, black people were very, very independent and extremely good at farming the land. So they didn't really need to work for the British farmers. So what the British did is that they imported Indians from India, South India, and they imported Malaysians from Indonesia and Malaysia and into the Cape. And the Indians were on the East Coast working the cane fields. And they said, well, you can go to the colonies, South Africa, better life. You get on a ship, and a couple of years later, you work off your passage. If you work a number of years after that, you get a piece of land. My great grandparents had a piece of land on the East Coast that we used to visit. The first time I ever saw a pineapple tree was on that piece of property. It was a beautiful
No.
subtropical kind of, not very good for farming, but it was just so beautiful. Monkeys and all sorts of fruit trees. And we used to go visiting the old people there. So, so there is that history of real terrible enslavement. And if you just look at the number of suicides that happened during Indian indenture, it just tells its own story. People would literally burn themselves alive, hang themselves to get out of, this life of slavery to the British. So it was an extremely difficult experience. And Mahatma Gandhi actually came at one point. So when he was in South Africa, he was working for Indian rights. It was during apartheid, so it was long after indenture ended, by for the most part. But it was still like, the legacy of working for the rights of a people that was cut off from their homeland of India, that didn't have representation in a country very, very far away from their home, where they were the real minority. So, you can say what you want about Mahatma Gandhi and his early racism and things like that, but the point is that he was really working for people who were, enslaved and didn't have a voice. The other thing is, yeah, so the British, we have a complex relationship with the British, especially since, when you had apartheid, it wasn't the British that brought us apartheid, it was the Dutch. And you had a lot of Brits coming out after apartheid ended, and even during, saying, that they didn't agree with it and everything else. So there's a lot of complexities around it. And, you know, I grew up in a part of the country that's extremely British and have a, you know, a large number of friends and things that are British descent. And I do, you know, I think it's a little bit of a complex history because I feel like the British have kind of like accepted a more, you know, rainbow nation in a way that is a little bit more genuine and a little bit more integrative than the Afrikaners have. So it is complex, but it's like, you know, the lesser of two evils kind of situation.
And so correct me if I'm wrong, but the way it seems to have gone, there was a period, I think, in the early 1900s where there wasn't really that much racism, or it wasn't as strong as it then became, say, post 50s and 60s and 70s, when it was really apparent. You know, it was very dominant. And like I say, you know, even today you still get district, I mean, we can get into District 6 and everything there, but even now you still get districts where it's predominantly black and other districts which are predominantly white, and there's more amenities and open spaces in the white dominated part versus the black dominated part. Is there still, and again, I know you don't live there now, but is there still a lot of the knock-on effect where, you know, the areas that the black people were pushed to, or just the colored people were pushed to, that they are still very deprived?
Oh, 100%. Like the legacy of apartheid. I mean, it's also just the legacy of 250 years of limiting the rights of black and non-white people across South Africa. So, you know, it started with black farmers really competing against white farmers and the British who had colonized the country under Cecil John Rhodes, you know, were starting to implement laws and things to limit how where black people could live, where they could farm, how they could you know compete in the economy, the commercial farming economy. So then you get that to finally to 1950s after the Anglo-Boer Wars, and you know we have a democracy, kind of not really because only white people could vote. And so you know you have a voting system, you have a presidency, and the National Party comes into effect. And you know you're right in terms of before the National Party, before apartheid really came into effect, you did have more mixing between the races, and you have this race which is called by themselves, it's not an offensive term in South Africa, the colored people, which simply means a mixed race people. But back then it was just you know people with different colored parents that
Just a way to
would,
identify, yeah.
yeah, well, they weren't even called colored at that point. They were just mixed race people, right? And during apartheid, because, you know, part of the foundations of apartheid, the religious dogmatic foundations of apartheid that were used to kind of convince the masses, at least the white masses, that this was the right thing to do, was, you know, that there was, we were breeding an impure race. That white people and black people were mixing and they were giving rise to this impure race, and that was going against some kind of Christian belief system and blah blah blah. So that was like one of the sort of the reasons that was advertised, the propaganda around it. And so you know part of apartheid was to move people in their races, in their into their race groups out of very mixed race neighborhoods, some of which are Sophiatown up in Soweto and District 6 in Cape Town, also parts of Durban where Indians lived, and they were forcibly removed, and families were split up. Like parents were split from their children, brothers and sisters were split up, and they had to live in different neighborhoods because of the color of their skin. And they were meant to, you know, I have a colored friend, family friend who had a white mother, and she would, as a small 4-year-old child, have to ride on a different class of train to her mother. It's nuts. So, I mean, this was the law. That's the other thing. It's like segregation in the US, there were some, you know, laws and things, but this was like the country's law, the law of the country. And it was illegal for you to live in a different neighborhood. And, you know, and it's also like, you know, there was just a little bit of like a hierarchy established between the races, which is the diabolical, you know, genius of apartheid. You know, when you have a minority oppressing a majority, the only way to do it is to diabolically devise a system where everybody is complicit in maintaining the status quo. So they created different neighborhoods, and different races had access to different jobs and things like that, through banding together. But it is true that the black people had it the worst. They were put in areas that were very far from the city centers. They were, given the lowest form of education. They were, if you look at the Soweto uprising, where hundreds of students were shot down and killed by police because they were rioting, protesting against what they called Bantu education, which is a very low basic form of education. Because why does a black person need to learn mathematics if he's just going to be working on the mines or cleaning a house? That kind of stupid mentality. And that's where you have the legacy of apartheid continuing to show. So people moved to these areas that just really didn't have any resources, living in really close quarters. You had the colored population in District 6, a vibrant population community with art and music and all sorts of interesting things. Now moving to the Cape Flats, a flat, desolate sort of project houses, and the rise of gangsterism that still plagues Cape Town as a result, direct result of that drugs and gangsterism that has arisen and that plagues the populations and the communities to still today, keeping them in poverty and keeping them unhealthy in very many ways. So you do see the legacy of apartheid continuing. And one thing that I plan on, being very outspoken about when I go back to South Africa, which is what I plan on doing soon, is to really, really, speak to the different races and, speak to the white people and say, listen, where is the German guilt of South Africa? Because South African whites act like nothing ever happened. And you also do hear them, talking about the good old days and everything, and it's disgusting. It's absolutely ridiculous. And there's a lot of, oh, we can't keep blaming apartheid for everything. But yes, no, we can. We can, especially since, we have this huge uprising, political uprising right now, where people are literally eating sand to curb their hunger because of COVID-19 and the effect that it's had. And you have, the white minority still hanging on to the majority of the wealth. And I mean, and a small black and very much so an Indian minority as well, sharing in on those gains, but not sharing it with the rest of the country. So, I'm definitely not leaving out the other races that have become very prosperous in the new South Africa that have also not done their part in uplifting the rest of the country, myself included.
Well, I mean, it's a couple of things there, which is so key. And firstly, that you want to go back and really make more noise around this conversation. I definitely think that's needed because it's just such a fascinating, deep history, which I don't think is publicized enough that people are aware. And I'm speaking from, coming from the UK, so it's obviously a very British education system, so it will obviously be framed in a certain way. But the other bit you mentioned around you drew to COVID and what's been happening recently. So brain drain has always been a huge, or I'd say always, I'd say in the last decade at least, a big issue for South Africa, probably longer than a decade, where the most skilled professionals, and especially in fields of engineering, tech, these kind of very upcoming and highly educationally required skill sets and professions, they are leaving in the masses, right? I think I read somewhere that for every one skilled professional that comes into South Africa, there's eight that are leaving. And you mentioned COVID. I mean, the figures have only got much worse. I think it's really accelerated this issue that they have, where I think around 90% of the tax has been coming from the middle class. So with this brain drain ongoing, and then it all amplified by COVID, where you're left with this workforce that are of a lower class, say, and they've been forced into unemployment. I mean, we're only a year removed from these numbers of that middle class halving. So, along with that loss of an intelligent labor force, you're looking at South Africa really suffering from not getting that tax revenue that it was, which is only, from now going forward going to be felt. So,
No, I totally agree. I think you're making some really, really important points. And I think that a big part of me moving back to South Africa is, I've been paying taxes to the US government for the last 6 years. And that's something that I feel a little bit conflicted about. And I'd rather pay my taxes to my homeland, than go for citizenship in the US and then have to pay the US government taxes for the rest of my life, no matter where I live, which is the rule here, or at least in the US.
So, with what you're saying now, would you say you're a rarity in that thought process that you have?
Yes, I think that I'm a rarity, but I do think that, I don't know. I still have hope. I still haven't given up on South Africa. I still haven't given up on my generation that have gone off into the world. And I still have hope that some of us will come back and start leading. And it's my call to action as well for my generation that has left. And, we left for good reason. So there was, people have always been leaving South Africa before apartheid ended. After apartheid ended, lots of the whites left because they were like, oh, the country's going to the dogs, the racists. They can go to Australia and Canada. We don't need them. So then there was a lot of people that left, frankly, especially my generation that graduated around the recession. So I graduated 2010. There was a very, very little jobs going around at that point. I know a lot of people who graduated with good degrees from good universities in engineering and accounting and good things like that could just couldn't find a job. And I think that was compounded by the government's controversial sort of broad-based black economic empowerment, which is our affirmative action implementations, which had kind of peaked at that point. I think that they'd given the corporations 20 years to fix the problems and put non-whites in charge, get training programs, get sustainable development programs in place to actually uplift and empower and educate. And they weren't doing it. So they had to take more drastic measures and put more quota systems and really, really start slap smacking the country's corporate. So, I think that, a lot of people have a lot to say about BBBEE. I think that at some point the rubber has to hit the road. Things need to change, right? And they weren't changing fast enough. So we were leaving because, the country's economic status had been downgraded to junk, and we were like, okay, well, some of us, at least for me, I was like, if I need to get my if the country does devolve into a political situation and I need to get my family out quickly, maybe I should go and try and find citizenship somewhere else so that I can actually be that ability, have the ability to get folks out. I know you talk about you talk to folks that got out of Kenya quickly. So we don't have like a network outside the country to your family to sort of go and just quickly get out of the country if we need to. So there were those thoughts that went through my mind as well, and I know others as well. And then obviously there's just the constant crime situation in South Africa where attacks and robberies, rapes, murders, car hijackings. This is a very common story in South Africa. Not to scare anyone, it's a beautiful country, very good to visit and very, but there is that reality that you live under. There's this low level of fear. And I only really fully perceived what that really was when I lived outside the country for a period of time and really had that complete freedom of mind, which I never really felt in South Africa. So there is that, So there are some good reasons that some of us left, a lot of us left. But, me being a legacy of anti-apartheid struggle heroes and activists. My godfather was a political prisoner doing COVID operations for the ANC in the late 80s, captured, put in jail, tortured brutally for his role as a political prisoner. I was born while he was in jail, and he became my godfather, of course. His wife was a journalist in Cape Town. She's colored. She worked for a local sort of, oh, what do you call it? Like a activist journalist kind of thing, newspaper. And somehow, by some miracle, she got the first sketch of the old man, Nelson Mandela, that had come out. And they had banned everything. They had banned everyone that was talking about him, everyone that was singing about him. Miriam Makeba was exiled, and any imagery of him, because he was like the spirit of the country, that we it was a majority being oppressed, so you have to keep people's spirits down. And so somehow she got hold of this sketch that somebody had made and smuggled out of Robben Island of this old man. And he'd been in jail for like, what, 40 years, something years, very, very long time at that point. And so they decided they were going to like print this thing on the cover. But they knew that they might get caught. So she went out of the office. They printed a false front page. Office was raided by the police. Somehow it got leaked. Luckily, the false front page was there, so nobody said anything. I think it was like Saturday night they ran the paper. Oh no, I think it was Friday night they ran the paper, released it on Sunday with this cover, which is the Nelson Mandela, the sketch of this old man on the front page. Sunday they made international headlines. And this was a big deal because, South Africa was in the dark. Simon and Garfunkel wrote that song, Hello Darkness, My Old Friend, The Sound of Silence, because South Africa was in the dark from the world. The world didn't know what was happening in South Africa. They knew that it was bad, but it was like locked down. And so now any kind of thing like this that puts South Africa on the map is so impactful because, excuse me, because it tells our story. And it makes people listen. And that international pressure was a hugely impactful at making things change. Yeah, my parents were also activists. They were in college though, so they were a little younger and they would always do protests. My mom was this like a little bit of an intellectual muse. Like she was just so very like passionate and rallying the troops, and my father was like very good at organizing things. So he'd like print huge things, make banners, like COVID kind of things, make protests, organize boycotts, that kind of stuff. Yeah, so I'm a legacy of activists, and that was a big part of my journey these last 30 days.
No, it's super fascinating. And, something that you said about trying to get this into, more of mainstream media or just in front of more people outside the borders of South Africa would have such a significant impact. Do you think the reason that it hasn't happened so far is because the government has done so well at keeping it within the borders? Or is it more just a general ignorance from the population or journalists or news channels outside of the South African borders?
No, the South African government did everything that they could to suppress any kind of news or, there was lots of propaganda. There was a lot of false reporting. There was, everyone who was singing and talking about South Africa was exiled from the country. There were lots of people that were exiled. So, just cutting a communication off between what's happening in the country and those that are talking about South Africa outside of the country. And then you also have to realize the climate, the political climate at the time. It was like, it was a proxy war also going on because it was the fall of the Soviet Union happened in 1989, 88, 89. And this was around the time I was born in 88, January 88. So this was like the dark days of apartheid. And you had the ANC government that was being funded by the Russians, the Soviets. And you had the Americans funding the apartheid government. Yes, they were supporting the apartheid government. The South African apartheid government had four nuclear weapons. Four. That were, and how did they get the technology and the funding to do that? The US government. South Africa was a proxy war for what was going on in the world. And also, I think it was a little bit of geographical, location as well as, so the US government was actively promoting racism and oppression in South Africa. This is true. This is not, I'm not making this up. This is a history, this is facts. So it was not that they didn't know, it's just that they didn't care or they were on the opposite side of the table.
Yeah, that is insane. And, for me, it's really fascinating to hear it from someone who can give this firsthand account of what exactly it was like or, even is like. But so coming back to you, how was it like for you growing up there in terms of did you face those similar kind of struggles that that generation went through? Or, how was your ease of being able to integrate into diverse cultures and backgrounds while you were there?
Oh, I grew up colorblind, like completely free. Not colorblind, but I think just like totally integrated. My parents did an incredible job. So when we were kids, my father was a small town doctor. So he moved us to this teeny, teeny, tiny farming town in the countryside, about 2 hours from Durban. Beautiful little town, and there was this little private school that a couple of, British culture teachers had started that was, one of the first fully integrated schools post-apartheid. So I was, I think, 4 when apartheid ended, and 6 when Nelson Mandela became president, around that time started going to school, and lots of the schools were struggling with integration. Even if they were legally integrating people, I think culturally it was, I have stories of people who went to a school and experienced so much racism that they dropped out and went to the Indian school or the African school after that. But this group of teachers started a preschool. It was a primary, a preschool, like a grade R and grade naught, whatever they call it now, kindergarten. And every year, as the kids grew, they'd like add a year on. So eventually it became a primary school as well. And so we were there for most of my childhood, and it was a completely fully integrated school. We didn't know, all the teachers were white. That was the one thing. But, there were black kids. There were a couple of Indian kids, not that many white kids, mostly the teachers' kids that went to the school, the white kids, and a couple of other kids. So we grew up completely integrated. It was beautiful. And I think that I had a very different experience to a lot of South Africans my age. I think the ones that a little bit younger probably had a more similar experience to me and more integrated, at least the ones in the middle class. And I do say that with a little bit of understanding of my privilege here. My father was a doctor. He could afford to send me to a private school that was integrated like this. So others didn't have that ability, and they continued to stay at the Indian school, the black school, the colored school, the white school, whatever that was. So I think that I had a very special, fortunate experience in South Africa that kind of shaped my view of myself, my view of other people, my view of experience of racism. If I experience racism now, I feel like I don't take it personally. I kind of have, I almost have a little bit more empathy for the person on the giving end of the racism. And, just kind of putting myself in their shoes and understanding that they have had a life experience that was, that led them to this point to say or to act or behave in that way, which is unfortunate. But I don't see it as anything wrong with me, and I think that that is really wonderful.
Yeah, I really love that. It's such a powerful point, and I know a lot of the people listening will be able to relate to it because it doesn't just apply to these kind of negative comments. Though I think, experiencing that at such a young age and being able to develop that kind of mindset so early on is so important and quite admirable. But if you look at the rise of social media now, it's a huge talking point about how a negative comment can really negatively impact not even just the younger generation, but through all stages of life. It's that 5%, which could be of someone that has no relevance to the individual, but it can really draw on that person to fixate on those negative comments. And especially when people haven't really developed their EQ or are not used to getting this kind of online hatred, have suddenly been exposed to this, and it can be really damaging for someone's mental health. And that's again why mental health awareness combined with social media have become a huge, huge place in discussions these days.
I think one of your questions, your top five or your last five, was what do you wish that you'd known as a teenager? And what I was thinking is that if somebody doesn't like you, it doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with you. It just means that that person is just not your person. And that's completely okay. Not everybody needs to like you. And you just got to find your tribe and love them hard.
Another thing I wanted to draw on that you mentioned, which was, recognizing your privileges, because it's something that I've resonated a lot with from previous guests who've said something similar. One example being Saba, who was a guest recently. And where I draw the commonality is that for sure, you've seen the struggles that you've had to face and the previous generation have had to face, and some of the natural struggles that come with being, say, a third culture kid. But it's also recognizing the privileges that you've had, and firstly being grateful for them, but also that has acted as your tool for service to want to give and help those who haven't been given those same fortunes that you have.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. I mean, I wouldn't be able to live any other way, I think. And I think that we are at a point in, I'm trying to get a little bit more woo-woo, but I think we're at a point in the world where, you know, there's a shift happening for sure. And people call it all different things, but I do feel like there's a shift. People are starting to wake up to the reality that we are not living on a world of endless resources. This is a spaceship, right? Whatever we use turns into waste and we need to deal with it. And we live with each other and we all are responsible for the collective. And I think that the, you know, society in general has swung, especially with social media and, you know, being able to curate this perfect profile for yourself, where you are the center of your universe on social media and you can just curate it the way you want. We've swung, you know, this like very, very hard swing around identity and who I am and how I present myself in the world. This is all good and well. It needed to happen, but we've swung very, very far in the direction of individualism. And I think that what the world really, really needs is the pendulum to swing in the opposite direction, which is towards collectivism, towards more of a tribalism mindset, understanding that we are part of a collective. We are responsible for each other. We are not islands in the oceans, but we are a network that we are all connected. We're connected to each other. We're connected to the planet. We're connected to absolutely everything in this universe. So I think that understanding around it's not just about me, but it's about us is, I think, the sort of the philosophy that I'm really, really moving towards, and the world that I want to create, and the consciousness that I want to like wake up in people, because I believe that that is what we need. And that, you know, foundationally, when we all believe and we all understand at a very fundamental, like cellular level, how connected we are to everything else, we'll make different decisions. And that would just snowball.
No, I really, really love that. And it's a, you know, again, it's applying a principle that's quite heavily spoken about in all fields. You know, entrepreneurs talk about you can go far alone, but you can go even further in a team or in a group, right? It's this collective idea that, sure, people like to blow their own trumpet and, you know, there's the whole, at the end of the day, you only have yourself. But it, in terms of what you're saying, the power of working as a group and as a force, and like you say, as a collective, that's what really can cause that change that people want to see.
Or in service of the collective, even if you're doing work on your own, but in service of the collective.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that. Because, you know, it's something that I heard somewhere where there is no upper limit to the happiness you receive from serving others, right? I think there's only a certain amount that you can buy for yourself and do for yourself to bring you personal happiness. But it's kind of the more people you help, the happier you're going to be. And so were you the first of your family to leave South Africa?
Yes. Yeah. My family loves South Africa. You know, I've been trying to get one of my sisters to move to the US, and they said that they would rather move many other places in the world than the US. Before the US. No, my family loves South Africa. South Africans love South Africa. So I think it was a really big deal for me to leave. And I was supposed to be gone just 1 year, and then it turned into six. But you know how these things go.
I mean, that is a pretty big difference. But yeah, you're right. You know, it's just a prime example of you never really know what's around the corner, or that plans can change. But what would be interesting to know is, what did you manage to take from your upbringing and the situations that you went through and the mindset that you developed? How were you able to apply that to when you first did make that move to a foreign land?
You know, I think that it was really difficult. And I think that in many ways, I lost myself in the culture. And I think that, you know, I have a best friend who also moved to the US just a few years before me. And she moved with her South African husband. And I think that they have a much stronger sort of sense of self when it comes to their South African roots than I did. I was working with Americans, dating an American, living with Americans. All my friends were Americans for the most part, and so I think that it was really, really difficult to kind of maintain any sort of culture, especially like since South African culture and American culture are like superficially very similar in a lot of ways, in how we, you know, how we view authority. We're very like flat structured as well. We're you know, pretty bold, pretty you know, we speak our minds. So there's a lot of similarities between American culture and South African culture, but there's some distinct differences which really were tough for me. So South Africans are extremely warm and welcoming, and they're polite, superficially polite, which can be a little bit superficial, but they're very genuinely warm and welcoming. They love foreigners. And if you are new in town, and somebody would realize that you're new in town, maybe someone at work or someone you've met, they would invite you to their house for a braai, a barbecue, and they will mean it. They would be like, come over to my house on Friday, and they will message you, this is the time and this is the location, like come and bring friends and bring meat or whatever, or bring nothing, just bring yourself. And they will entertain you, introduce you to all their friends, invite you to other things. They're very warm and welcoming. And I'd get this thing in the US, which is very common, where somebody would like meet you and they're like, you know, in the office or whatever, they're like, oh, great. And then at the end, they're like, oh, I have to run, but we should get coffee. And you'd think that they were actually meaning that they wanted to get coffee, but no, that's just a polite way to just kind of end the conversation. They had no intention of ever getting coffee with you. And then you'd follow up with them and say, hey, let's go for that coffee. And then they'd like all sorts of things that they were, you know, excuses. And I, you know, it took me a little while to realize that people are pretty like island-like, very kind of like superficial in that way, especially on the West Coast in San Francisco. There's so many things to do. There's just like, you know, where are you going to be going on brunch this weekend? And I'm so busy, I'm so busy, I'm so busy. So, you know, there's just the, it's t I struggle to build those deep connections with people and build like a real community for a long time in the US. And that was really difficult for me.
It's really funny that you mentioned that actually, because it immediately reminded me of a guest that I had in season two called Esther. So she was originally from Australia and then moved to the US. She lived around the US but ended up in California. And she told a story of how when she would meet people, she would get along with them really well and thought she was making some great connections. And then she would often hear that, like, oh, hey, we should definitely keep in touch. Like, I'll have a barbecue and you should come around. That was my American accent. Some people are gonna hate that, but yeah. And then so she'd be excited, like, wow, I've really connected with someone, and then that invite would never follow up. And you know, in the beginning, I think it was she took it quite personally, like, oh wow, you know, did I do something wrong? Did I set a bad impression in some way? But then she came to realize it's just one of those things that it's so easily said that, oh, we should keep in touch, and it's probably said in a genuine good light, but there really isn't that actual authentic follow-up. Whereas in Australia, if you know she meets someone and she's like, oh, we're gonna have a barbie, you should come round, you know, there's a very high chance that she is going to have a barbecue in the coming weeks and that person will be remembered and invited. So you know, when she drew that comparison, it's something that she just had to get used to, that even coming from a country that speaks basically the same language, that cultural difference is so like striking. And you know, me being a Brit, we are great at that. But after having lived abroad and traveled around a lot, I've really consciously noticed that where people will genuinely mean and follow up, you know. I think it's more the follow-up piece. You know, when I lived in China, someone would say, oh, that sounds really interesting what you're doing. I actually know someone I can connect you with. Let's meet up for a coffee, discuss it, and I'll put you in touch with the person. And then when people actually started doing that, I was like, oh wow, you know, people genuinely mean and want to help others. And so I've consciously tried to do the same thing.
Yeah, acknowledgement is so important. Like, you know, in my work as a coach, acknowledgement is just, you know, it's just such an incredible tool to use in building relationships. And I do love hanging out with the hippies, or the global community of the hippies, because they are just, you know, all the love. It gets a little bit much though. I was speaking to an Italian guy that we went hiking a few times from the hostel, and he was saying about how PSEC is great, but like, you know, there's just this like, it's there's this weird energy of like love. Everyone is just like a little bit over the top about it. So he walked into a cafe, for example, and he said hello and he said like, hey, can I have one of these coffees or whatever? And then the guy behind the counter said, well, first I want to say that I love you, man. I love you. And he was like, okay. Okay, thank you. I love you too, but can I have some coffee?
Yeah, thank you. And I also love coffee, so please can I have mine now?
But yeah, no, I think the hippies do it really well. I can't complain.
That's brilliant. I love that. So you mentioned coaching, and when we first connected, that is what you were focusing on, or that, that's what I was introduced to you as the piece that you're working on and the expertise that you're building. But, since then, what I've also got to know about you is that you've worked at a very well-known global corporation in a very well-respected role. So the piece of the story I don't know is how your journey got you, say, from that point, and how that transition happened to get you into the coaching that I initially knew you for. Yeah, I'd love to hear how that came about and what the story was behind that.
Yes. So, I was a corporate assassin, I say. I worked at a top consulting firm, a very controversial, prestigious one. And I worked there for a long time. And they taught me incredible skills, did some incredible work, went all over the world, lived in Indonesia, worked in London, worked like, all over the world. It was great. I got great experience. Left that company, went into the startup space, had my own startup for a while, like a co-founder for tech startup. And I then did something. I did ayahuasca for the first time. This was like a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago now. And I was called to become a coach and a speaker and a writer. Well, writer, I think, comes out of that podcast. It comes out of that as well. But I was called to be a coach and a speaker. And after that experience, which was very powerful and beautiful and amazing, I quit the startup and decided that I was going to become a coach. And then I got scared and backslid back into corporate. I got like a spoke to a coach of mine. He said, yeah, it's great, but it's hard to start a coaching business. But there's an executive role at this really great company, and you can get all this experience and building coaching business on the side. And I was like, oh, that sounds like a really great plan. So I did that thinking I'd be there for 3 to 5 years, but it was all sorts of awful, and I regretted it from the very, very beginning, and I didn't even last the year. So I think it just accelerated the plan that I was called for in the beginning, which is to be a coach, and that has snowballed into podcaster, writer, activist, all sorts of things that will continue. Musician, DJ.
And do you think that if you hadn't ever gone through that first ayahuasca experience that you had, would you still have found your way into coaching? So, did the ayahuasca experience that you went through and that enlightening feeling act as a catalyst to get you towards what you are inevitably going to get to? Or did going through that whole journey really transform and shift lanes in your life and take you down this path that you probably wouldn't have found otherwise?
No, I think that it probably sped it up, because even when I was working in corporate, I think that the things that I loved to do was coach more junior colleagues. They'd always say that I was the coachy manager. They'd always, when I was a manager in consulting, they always gave me newbies to coach up, because they knew that I could turn people around really quickly. And so I think that it's just something that I was passionate about. I really enjoyed doing. So I think that it's something that I looked at as like, my post career, retirement kind of work, and it just kind of accelerated it.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love hearing that, and especially those areas that you mentioned. I mean, I've been following your journey on Instagram, and for anyone else who's intrigued by what you're saying, then I highly recommend that they give you a follow. And obviously, your details will be in the show notes. But I even remember seeing in your story when you were DJing. So I have a firsthand, or at least social media firsthand experience of seeing that. But yeah, I'd love to know, for you now, having gone through everything you have up to this point, why do you think it's coaching, or why do you think it's your calling to coach?
I think that there's something around, and I don't even know if I'm like, if I, you know, right now I'm in a bit of a crossroads. There's just, I'm just kind of, the universe is just leading me. I'm in this post ayahuasca dieta period where I'm just kind of going with the flow. And I'm at a point where I don't know whether the coaching business will con I will continue working on the coaching business, or whether I will, I plan on writing my book, so taking some time off, going to South Africa, writing my book, finishing my podcast, and working on art and music for the next at least 6 months to a year. And not, you know, I've got some coaching work coming my way thanks to my network, and that's some good money coming in. But I'm not sure if the coaching work was just a skill set that I had to learn, because it helps with other things. It helps incredibly as an interviewer in a podcast. It helps incredibly in connecting with other people in writing and everything else, or whether that's you know, a career for my own. So yeah, right now I just don't know. I really am called. I'm feeling very, very called to do more of the arts, writing, singing. I've been writing a lot of songs, making music, producing music, and DJing, and speaking out on the things that I believe in. So I think I'm gonna really just focus on that, and if coaching work comes to my way, I won't turn it down if I need.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm really glad I got to ask you that, because from your answer, it really puts this nice wrapper around everything that you're doing and how it ties together. But for you, what really is the impact that you're looking to make? You know, if you boil it all down, what is that influence that you're looking to have through these things that you're doing?
Oh yeah. So I think that the underlying all of these things is, the strong purpose of enablement. So I think that I have walked in the shoes of leadership myself, in various kind of areas, corporate, nonprofit, in my family. I've been a leader in various forms. And I think I'm moving into a space where I don't need to be in the seat of power. I want to, my role, I'm seeing my role as really enabling other leaders through my work as a coach, but also through my writing, through my sort of influence, through my friendship. And one of my intentions, one of my last intentions, what I would like to understand. So, just to give you a little bit of background, each ceremony you ask Mama Ayahuasca, the grandmother, for an intention. And the shamans listen to this intention, and then they sing to you a special song called Ikaros to help you. They sing to the spirit of the plants to help, bring this birth, this manifest, this intention into life. And so the intention that I asked for the ceremony was to understand my role in accelerating the return of female leadership in the world, in accelerating the return of female leadership in the world.
Okay, that's interesting. So
Yes.
return and in the world, this implies that it was commonplace and, as you say, in the world, so quite globally. So the question really is, at what point was it commonplace, and how extensive do you mean by the world, and where or how did that get lost?
Yeah, so this is a whole other book that I started writing after my first book called Heart Song, which is chronicling my experiences in the jungle. But the second book that I'll write, or one of the books that I'll write, is, it doesn't have a title yet, but it's essentially looking at pagan traditions, pre-patriarchal traditions, and looking at how important goddesses were in the world, and how understanding of, just this, the feminine, the sacred feminine, the ability to birth life into the world. The reason that we have all life in the world is because of, the fact that women have periods. Like, that's just why, So we have the sacred power, the sacred gift. And, even like if you think about being reborn, baptism, being reborn, born. You're born to a woman and you're dirty, you're a sinner, but you have to be reborn through the church, through a man, to be worthy of heaven, to be clean of your sins. They took birth from us. So yeah, if you look at ancient traditions from The ones that we know about, Hindu cultures, they're one culture that kept their female goddesses. So we can look at Hinduism, but if you look at pagan traditions from the Greeks to the Romans to the Gaelics, and then also I've been doing research on pre-Islamic Arabian goddesses. There were three goddesses that represented the triple goddess, which is the maiden, the mother, and the crone. So, I'm really moving into this, like have been. I think I'm probably already shifted, but I've been struggling with moving from maiden to mother in the phases of a woman's life. And I've kind of finally just shed the mantle of the maiden and moved fully into the mother. And I know women, especially the women in America, that struggle from moving to the mother, from the mother to the crone state of being. Like, especially since in America, if you're an older woman, like there's just no role for you in society. They cling to this like motherhood kind of thing, because old women are just like, they bake things and they're just really sweet and lovely, but they don't really have like a real crunchy role. Whereas if you look at our traditions, like we have matriarchs. We go to our older woman for advice, for counseling. They make decisions about things, especially like things like around, hey, if somebody wants to get married, like, they go to my nani and ask her for permission. She probably won't say no, but she'll have an opinion about it. There were goddesses of not only goddesses of fertility and love and all these beautiful things, but they were goddesses of filth. They were goddesses of destruction. They were goddesses of pain. All the parts of being a woman that help us understand how, the complex, reality of being a woman. And over centuries, these traditions, these cultures, and this medicine, the medicines and the respect for the female, sacred feminine, and the sacred feminine arts and the spirituality that came with sacred feminine were erased from the world.
Wow, that is fascinating. And I can tell there's so much more that you have to offer in terms of a knowledge base around what you want to share. And one thing it reminded me of is, so some of the listeners will already know about my spiritual journey. There was a bonus episode where I spoke about it. But one of the teachings that I've learned from there is this concept that the soul is actually a feminine energy. And for some that might be hard to grasp as a concept, because you might suddenly think that, oh, I don't want to be associated with the soul if it means that I'm a feminine way of being. It's not really that. It's, the idea of a lot of the qualities that derives or resides more in our soul is this idea of this caring, loving nature, right? We all want to be loved as human beings, as a species. And the most satisfaction we get is from service, whether it's service to family, in some cases service at work, service to friends. We get more joy out of serving others than we do ourselves, and that's something that everyone can relate to in some capacity. So, just listening to the things that you've only touched the surface on, I just know that as soon as, some people get hold of your content, it's just going to do so well. So I'm really excited for you.
This all came out of the jungle, right? This experience in the jungle, all these insights, all of, I mean, it's something that I've been researching for a long time, but I think that it's just all coming together in the songs that I was writing, in the book that I was writing, it's just in the feelings. And it's just, I think that you're right in terms of the feminine being very like nurturing, giving, caring, loving. But the feminine is not only those positive things. The feminine is like, look at the goddess Kali, the goddess of destruction. And this is like, fundamental part of life. Everything in this world will come go to dust. We will all die, we'll become the soil. And it's like very, very visceral in our bodies. That happens every single month. Like our uterus fills up and then it destroys itself. It is a sort of sacred thing that happens in our bodies. We are very, very connected with that, the phases of the moon linked to that. And so like, it's destruction is very feminine as well. And if you've ever been scorned a woman, you will know how
To the
destructive.
listener, if you have had any experience with a destructive woman, or you consider yourself a destructive woman yourself, then feel free to reach out to either one of us and we will take your comments on board.
Speaking from personal experience.
Yeah. But no, I'm really excited for you to release the episodes of your 30-day journey because, you know, even from this conversation today, I think the listener will be able to grasp that, you know, it's there's been such a positive change and I can really sense it, you know, just how happy and blissed out you are from your experience. So I think it's going to be amazing stories to hear. And, you know, without giving too much away, if you just want to give the listener a few more insights, you know, tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, sure. So I'll quickly just give a little bit of a background to what it all was. So if you know about ayahuasca, it is a vine that you mix with another plant and it makes it a very, very potent tea that Amazonian shamanic people have been using for centuries. It's an extremely hallucinogenic experience, but not recreational at all in the slightest. There's a very, very large lots of pain, lots of purging, vomiting, diarrhea, all sorts of crazy things. It's very difficult. This last 30 days was probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my whole life. There were times that I really wanted to quit. There were times that I just didn't think I was going to be able to make it. It was very, very tough. And you're in isolation when you're not doing the ceremonies as well, in a hut in the jungle with tarantulas and snakes and spiders and all sorts of crazy stuff. So yeah, there's little teasers for the podcast. So yeah, it was really, really tough, but like the best thing I've ever done in my whole life. And I'm planning on doing it again multiple times in the future. And 30 days is a long time to do something like this. Most people do 10. So 30 days was the real deal. So I did that for 30 days. And just to give you a little bit of an insight, coming in, I had lost my job at this corporate. I was a bit devastated. Had started my business, but it just like things just weren't clicking. Things weren't just falling into place. I'd moved in with my boyfriend who asked me to be his life partner. And our relationship was really, really struggling with addiction, struggling, you know, with all sorts of crazy things in our relationship. And yeah, I was in a really, really tough spot. I don't know if you picked this up when we chatted, but my life was a little bit of a mess. And coming out on the other end, completely, completely in my power, completely sure of my purpose, even though I don't know exactly, you know, it's not always good to plan out too much. I've never been like a super clear planner. Have a goal, have a vision, and have a purpose, right? And then the universe figure out the rest. So I might not have like a clear plan, but I have a very strong vision and a purpose. And completely healed, mind, body, and spirit. Like I had chronic depression and anxiety. I was taking antidepressants for the last 8 years since I started consulting. It was prescribed for insomnia as part of anxiety disorder. I was seeing a therapist weekly. I'm off the pills now for the first time in 8 years. And I don't plan on ever going back on them. I had chronic back pain. Thank you. I knew it was psychosomatic. I was at a chiropractor for, you know, all the time, constantly in pain. It's gone. And those are just some of the highlights that came off it. And many, many, many more. There's a lot of musicality that came out of it, which is why my podcast is called Heart Song, which is a song. I named it Heart Song because there's a tribe in Colombia that is a shamanic tribe called the Cofan. And they are extremely into very, very strong psychedelics, even stronger than ayahuasca. And when they have ceremonies, the entire village will partake. And it's an all-night kind of celebration. And every single member of this community has an individual heart song that they will learn through the medicine. The medicine will teach them, the spirits will teach them their heart song. And as many people as there are in this society, that's how many heart songs they were. And one of my intentions in the ceremonies was to learn my heart song. And I achieved every single intention that I set. And over the next 2 days after that, sitting in that intention, I sat crying my eyes out, writing the song. So if you'd like to know about that story and the song and all the other songs that were written along the way, tune in for Heart Song. it's just a beautiful journey. So.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff. And, you know, I haven't really heard anyone speak about doing something like this. So I love the, you know, when unique things like this come out. And so obviously, you know, like I said, I'll have your contact details in the show notes so people can, you know, follow you on Instagram, follow you on Facebook, wherever it may be, and keep in touch to find out when Heartsong may be released, right? Because, you know, I could ask you, hey, you know, what's your planned release date? But, you know, as we know, things don't always go exactly to plan and dates change and whatnot. So, yeah, easier for someone to follow you, get to know you a bit through that way, and then just be really excited for Heartsong as well. And something that you mentioned about, you know, not knowing exactly how something may unfold or what it's going to look like, but still having that big vision and, you know, the impact that you want to make. It's something that I've mentioned in a couple of episodes now, but, you know, it relates to this as well, which is the quote by Reid Hoffman, where he says, an entrepreneur is someone who throws themselves off a cliff and then figures out how to save themselves on the way down. I relate it to being a purpose-driven risk taker. Because, you know, saying entrepreneur, people have their own definition of it and they may bracket it to a certain type of person. But you're purpose driven, you know, it's easy to tell. And you have this vision of what you want to do. But, you know, you've even said that you don't know exactly what it's going to take to get there, but you have that belief in yourself that you either have the network or the skills or what it takes to figure out how to do so on the way. And that's taking that risk and just being like, I'm not going to stay in this feeling of a dead end, which, you know, honestly, some people have accepted that kind of fate. But you know, you have the ability to drive forward with something that you believe in. It's an amazing skill and quality and mindset to adopt.
I mean, it's really just trusting yourself because you are incredibly creative, you are incredibly resourceful, and you are whole. And so holding yourself as naturally resourceful, creative, and whole, knowing that you can solve your own problems, knowing that you have everything that you need, all the tools that you need, and if you don't, you are resourceful enough to go out and get them. And I've always like loved to have a goal, but which is helpful in terms of what to say no to and what to say yes to. And then taking the opportunities as they arise, because life will throw you opportunities. The universe will give you chances, they'll give you omens. And if you are super stuck in a plan, you're going to say no a lot to those incredible opportunities. Now, some of those opportunities might not make you reach your goal. Those ones, fine, say no to. But some of them are like, I was asked to DJ a second time here in PSAC, and I was just like, I don't really know if I want to do this. And I was thinking, oh God, but like, I did it, and I'm so glad I did because it just taught me that I was able to make the best out of like a terrible situation where all the equipment was wrong and everything was broken. And I was like, okay, now I learned all these skills. I built all this other new networks of people who now are following me. And when the universe comes knocking, when the telephone rings, are you going to pick up?
I love that. And I think it's a really strong message to finish on. And, you know, it's something that I discussed in the episode with Shavika, where it was initially from a conversation I had with another guest called Lucas Scrobot. And he talks about something called a divine appointment. And it's this idea that, you know, as you say, the telephone comes ringing, where there's these moments that occur in life where, number one, you have to identify them. So you need to be someone who is aware. And secondly, it's then acting on it or taking that opportunity. You know, it can be regarded as a divine appointment, no matter how big or small, because if you manage to call on it or action it, it could take you down the trajectory of the purpose you're looking to achieve, or, you know, speed it up, help you change lanes, whatever it may be, where you could see it as this kind of divine intervention to help you along. And if you don't take it, you know, it might just mean that it's delayed and you have to be more aware.
Yeah, well, don't beat yourself up too much about it. Remember, I backslid back into corporate
Yeah. No, sure.
after the universe came calling. And, although it was really a terrible experience, it taught me so much. And I wouldn't be here today in the person that I am. Probably wouldn't have gone to the jungle for 30 days if it wasn't for that whole experience. So don't beat yourself up. There's learnings around every corner.
Exactly, spot on. Well, thank you so much for all of those points that you've shared. It's been awesome. And we're not done yet because now we get to move on to the final five, if you're ready for that.
Final five, yay.
Now that sounds like someone who is definitely ready.
Sure.
Okay, so I'll kick off with question one.
Sure, let's go.
What is the worst piece of advice that you've ever received?
Don't study engineering, study medicine. That was my parents. So the universities in South Africa, at least, you have to give your first choice, your second choice. So they made me put medicine on all my first choices. And I put engineering, mechanical engineering, as all my second choices. And then that year, they changed the rules where you had to take a special test, an additional test to study medicine. So I got all these letters in the mail to take the test, and I threw them all away before my parents saw them from all these universities, and they all rejected me for medicine. And then they all accepted me for my second choice, which was mechanical engineering.
Well, there you go. That's probably as clear a sign as ever. Love it. I love that. And so, question two, what is the difference between a leader and a manager?
Yeah, a leader, I think a manager tells you exactly what to do and how to do it. And a leader sets the vision and then helps you grow big enough to figure out how to get there yourself.
So, would you say that all leaders are managers, or all managers are leaders, or can they often be, completely different characteristics of people?
I think that I mean, great. I've had great leaders who are also great managers. Like sometimes that you just have to be a little bit more tactical, and it also depends. Like I, as a leadership coach, I train corporates to move from operator to manager to leader, and there is a little bit of a mindset shift as you go through it. So, but when you're a manager, that doesn't mean that you don't have to get your hands on the dial sometimes. When you're a leader, doesn't mean that you don't have to be on the shop floor, and doesn't mean that you don't manage, but you have a different perspective. It's almost like taking a map and you can see like all the details because you can now zooming it out. Now you can see the city or at least the neighborhood, and now zooming it a little bit more and you can see the whole city. And that's the difference between an operator, a manager, and a leader.
Oh yeah, I love that. No, I love the way you've said that. And I really do hope that the listener has been attentive in what you've said, or goes back and rewinds and listens to it again, because I think the way that you just brought that all together in your explanation and brought that across was, you kind of hit the nail on the head. So it's amazing. And so moving on to question three, complete the following. Expertise means
Expertise means applying a piece of knowledge or content to a range of different applications and understanding, that broad set. And I think we think a lot of expertise as like a very narrow, deep field, and we don't think of it as like a broad understanding of how something pretty narrow can be applied. But I feel like there's a we don't give broadness and range enough credit in our society.
so from what I understand of it, expertise is when you are so good in a particular area or skill set or knowledge base that you're able to apply that expertise across multiple different fields, aside from the most obvious use case of whatever that expertise is in.
And that's where you get Nobel Prizes. That's where you win Nobel Prizes. It's actually at the intersection and, big, huge technology startups that do well. It's the intersection of two different fields of expertise, or two or three coming together. I talk a lot about this on my main podcast, Enormous Issues, Audacious Ideas.
Yeah, no, I completely get that. It's not a way that I've ever thought about in before or heard someone describe it. Amazing. And question four, what do you think will be, or what do you think is bound to be the most common characteristic amongst the most successful and respected future leaders?
Authenticity. Yeah, I think that there was a lot of times in corporate where I said and, verbally or non-verbally agreed, was complicit with certain things, concepts, ideas, positions, opinions, things like that, that I did not believe in. So I guess authenticity and integrity. So having a authenticity, I think, is like living your values, or at least being true to yourself, knowing who you are, being a true person. And then I think integrity is living your life, making decisions every day in line with that authentic self.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I strongly agree with that. And it'll be interesting to know what people think in general, whether they, they agree with that what you've said, or have a completely different take on what those values would be. So, if you're listening and you have a particular view, and it could be that you agree with it, then feel free to send a DM on the Instagram page, or on the Facebook, or even comment on the post for this episode. And yeah, I'm really, really intrigued to hear what views other people have. And so the final question, would the world be a happier or less happy place if it operated under one belief system or one way of thinking?
I don't agree with that. I think that there's just so much that we can learn from how we each other does things. And I spent 30 days working with these two beautiful shamans and just seeing the similarities and differences. There was an older woman and an older man. Just seeing the similarities and differences between how, Olinda, who's the shaman, Maestra Olinda, she was, how she sat, how she touched us, massaged us, and how similar that was to my Muslim grandmother, and then also how different it was in her style. And just so much that we can learn from each other if we can just put our egos aside and just approach things with beginner's mind.
No, that's great. It's not the range of beliefs out there that need to change. It's the person's open-mindedness to all of the differences that needs a bit of shifting.
Yeah, and respect, and just approaching everything with curiosity, and just reduce trying to be humble as well. I'm not here like, I came here from traditions that are lauded around the world, is very like, Hindu traditions, of course, have been very highlighted in the world with yoga and meditation and mindfulness and all those things. And I came here without any of that baggage, without any of that trying to put that on anyone else, or trying to be like, oh, I do yoga, I do this, and that's amazing. I came here to learn something new. I came here to put everything I knew aside, even though I hadn't done lots of research on ayahuasca and etc. I came here with to really understand how a different way and learn.
Amazing. I mean, thank you so much for sharing those answers, but sharing everything you've done over the last hour. And just for that final bonus question, so if you could describe your third culture experience or upbringing in a 6-word sentence, what would it be?
I can do it in eight. My heart song calls me back to my homeland.
Oh, that is strong. Yeah, I like that a lot. I love how it encapsulates, that piece that you're working on now with Heartsong, but how it really ties into taking you back to your home. So it's kind of doing that full circle of your experiences and everything you've gained and everything you want to give back coming out through this. And I always say this, but I really do mean it, that, of the people listening, even if there's just one person who genuinely it has a change in the way they think about something, or it gets them to take a certain action based on what you've said, then I'm already truly happy at what, this conversation has done. And I've learned a lot, and to really understand the teachings that you've gone from it, the learnings that you've been through, and how you're now ready to communicate that to the world in the forms that you're doing it. I genuinely am excited for you to be doing that. And I'm glad you shared what you did on this episode. So all I can really say is good luck, and I'm glad that we've got in touch and will be in touch going forward.
And thank you so much. You're such a special person, and I'm just very grateful that we were able to connect. And you should look out for Enormous Issues, the Audacious Ideas, which will release season two with Anand Datani. You've been bumped up to season two.
Yes, I have. Looking forward to releasing that. I remember that being a great chat. So that is going to be fun to re-listen to again. Thank you very, very much, and cannot wait to be in touch again soon. And it's a pleasure, as always, wherever you are in the world, to have you joining me for this conversation. If you're able to connect with something that was discussed, feel free and please do share the episode with someone who can resonate. Tag them on Instagram as well. The podcast page can be found at The Journey Onwards Podcast, and you can follow the link in description to get you there. People ask me what my end goal is for the podcast. Along with connecting deeper with all of the interesting people in my life, I'm also building out a platform where each of you can showcase your expertise and passions from the lens of being a third culture individual. If you're interested to be a part of this growing tribe, then head over to podcast.thejourneyonwards.com/tribe, leave me your email address, and I'll be in touch with more details. As always, I am super grateful for the feedback that you sent to me, as well as your reviews on Apple Podcasts. I'll be back next week for another episode. So until then, I really hope your next week is even better than the last.